Today I thought I would describe a little bit about first science release, and importantly, why we think we know what we say we know from a fuzzy, fiery donut. But to begin, I want to take us on a tour of the night sky. I should plug in my advancer.
We also have a hockey stick.
I also have a hockey stick, but that does not advance my slides. Tour of the night sky. Beginning with what the night sky would look like if we had a beautiful, clear day like today here in Waterloo.
You mean clear night, not
clear night.
Okay.
Well, sure. Back in May. So don't look up today. So you can see the constellation of Virgo. And as we zoom in step by step, we come to the Virgo supercluster. This is a cluster of galaxies, thousands of galaxies all orbiting together. And the brightest cluster galaxy in Virgo is M87. As we approach ever further in, you can start to see a prominence from the core of M87. That's not just an artifact, that's real. That's M87's jet, a relativistic, highly beamed outflow of particles and electromagnetic fields. And here's the iconic Hubble image of this jet shown on kiloparsec scales. To go any further, we have to forego optical telescopes and transition into the radio regime. And here's an image from the VLA. And longer, long wavelengths becoming ever shorter to go to higher resolution. And looking finally at Earth-sized telescopes, the VLBI images at long wavelengths. And we have a couple more zoom ins. And you can begin to see the jet has a great deal of structure. It's limb brightened. And it's not conical. It has this parabolic structure, which is predicted by our best models for how jets form. And in early April, for April 10th of this year, this was the highest resolution of M87 that had ever been produced, image of M87 that had ever been produced. This is by the GMVA at 3 millimeters, another global interferometer. For those of you who are keeping track, we've zoomed in by a factor of about 70 million. So it's the wonders of geometric sequences or exponentiation. And this is the image I want to talk about. This was what we released on April 10th, the image from the EHT. So I did that for two reasons. So the first reason was to highlight the fact that M87 is not a typical average place. It's an extraordinary place. It's the center of a supercluster, and it's in fact the largest galaxy in that supercluster. Galaxies orders of magnitude large, two orders of magnitude larger than the Milky Way. The black hole at the center is extraordinary in its mass, and it has a powerful jet. And second, just to confront the statements that why is it so fuzzy, which we got repeatedly. Well, that's why, because we made a quantum leap in resolution and just barely can resolve the thing that we were after, the event horizon of a black hole. And so in what follows, I'm going to tell you what this is in theory, how images like this were made, but then very importantly, how we get scientific results off of this, how we make measurements, and why we think they mean what we think they mean. So what are we looking at? So there's a great deal of machinery that goes into making images like the one we just saw. There's simulations of accretion flows in jet launching regions, radiative transfer calculations, propagation in general relativistic spacetimes, et cetera. But there's really only two pieces of physics that we need to talk about to get the gross features. And the first is gravitational lensing. So this is purely gravitational. It's just the deflection of light around the central mass. And this leaves as a signature this shadow, this dark region in the interior, which is literally the image of the horizon. That is, all the rays that connect from the source to us in that dark shadow region connect down to the horizon. So if there was going to be bright emission within that region, it would have to be in the foreground or it would have had to have begun
at the horizon.
This is the what?
Light ring. I mean, it's literally the image of the horizon.
I mean, it's literally the image of the horizon. Now, we can dither about the fact that the photons that form the bright region around never get closer than the photon orbit.
Yeah.
That's not always exactly true, by the way. It's only true if the photons came from behind or outside. Mm-hmm. But this is the image of the horizon in the sense that the black part is the collection of photons that would have begun at the horizon.
Why is there no activity in front of the black thing? What do we see?
This is a cartoon. When we see simulations, let's come back to that. This is a cartoon making the point of gravitational lensing. We'll come back to that in a minute. Okay. There is. Of course, this has a purely gravitational effect. There are strong predictions for what this should look like. For M87, we believe we're looking down the jet at an inclination of 10, 20 degrees maybe. So very close to the axis of symmetry of the system and presumably down on the spin. So regardless of the spin of the black hole in M87, we expect a very circular shadow, a very circular light ring, a photon ring. Of course, it didn't have to be that way. It's always worth remembering. It could be the wrong size. It could be the wrong shape. It could be a kidney bean. But it isn't. The second piece of physics that we need to worry about is dynamics, is the kinematics of the emission region. And this is just belaboring the point on jets. Here's a picture of Centaurus A. So it's a galaxy not all that unlike the Milky Way. All the stars you see are in the foreground. Centaurus A is this kind of milky white business, and we see the dust lanes. And if we were to look at it in radio, we'll see these large extensions or protrusions above and below the galactic plane. These are these relativistic jets. And these relativistic jets are quite important astronomically. They extend the influence of the black hole out to intergalactic distances, and we believe are responsible for a good part of feedback, just controlling how gas accretes onto galaxies, and especially massive galaxies controls their growth. And you can see that in this image, which shows radio relics of jets in eras past in red, carving holes in the hot intracluster medium, which you see in X-rays in the blue. And so there are these cavities where you see bright red, you see less blue. And then the galaxies in this cluster of galaxies are all shown in white. So the black hole at the center of the galaxy, at the center of this cluster, are controlling the properties of the gas in the cluster that would ultimately rain down. So they are important astronomically. If you want to understand why the night sky looks the way it does, we have to understand how these jets are launched. And the picture for how they're launched is in the context of a hot, radiatively inefficient accretion flow, which advects in magnetic fields, which are then twisted up either by rotation of the gas around the black hole or rotation of the black hole itself, leading to an initially helical outflow that then becomes largely poloidal due to angular momentum conservation. The jet's moving relativistically. In fact, everything's moving relativistically down near the black hole. We have orbital velocities of order, the speed of light. And then as we go further out, eventually this jet has to accelerate at least to Lorentz factor of 6. Okay, so very close to the speed of light at some point between where it's being launched and where those velocities are measured. And the key part there is those high velocities impart structure in the image as a consequence of Doppler beaming and Doppler shifts. The net result being that a typical image for something like M87 ought to have gravity shadow, ought to have that strong lensing effect. There can be foreground emission. But then it should have a bright side associated with the regions where material is coming towards us, and a dim side associated with the region where material is not coming towards us. Okay, a Doppler boosted side, and a Doppler deboosted side. And you can see the counterjet in the region around. So this was a picture we made 10 years ago, back when the mass of M87 was 3.5 billion. So,
so to answer that question, I'm saying there's foreground emission and background because there's that buildup around the ring.
That's right. So there's definitely So let's separate for a moment the details that go into generating the apparently bright circular feature, okay? And just highlight that as a scale in the image. Typically, this bright feature constitutes 10, maybe 20, maybe 30%, it depends upon the details, the dynamics in the model, of the total luminosity in the image. Okay, so even though it's very bright, so your eye keys in on it, there's a great deal more flux coming from this extended emission generally. And of course, we see whatever's there. But yeah, this is a buildup of emission on that region. But you can see in more modern GRMHD, more recent GRMHD simulations, foreground emission that's inside. Okay, but the gross features are the same. We have a bright side, a dark side, and a shadow. And that's generic across many different simulations of this type. So this is kind of what we expected to see in lower resolution, a shadow that's brightened on one side, and that side is not necessarily in the direction of the large-scale jet.
Could I ask a question? If you have such large Doppler broadening, shifting on the one side versus the other, can your telescope actually see the whole image in one waveband, or you have to piece it together?
Well, we're looking at continuum emission.
Okay. Yeah. So, but it's right. A different part of the continuum.
That's right. Yeah. The shifting is important, but less so than the boosting.
But do you have to model this continuum emission in order to piece it together?
All of these calculations do have a physics-based emission model in them. Yeah. So this one has, I believe, primarily thermal electrons of various temperatures, dependent upon details in the simulation and assumptions about electron heating. This other guy from before has power law and so power law tail and all. So you know, we worry about that. But it's all synchrotron. Okay, so that's kind of the framework that I want to place in your mind. What in the world is that image that we looked at? Images in practice. So the great challenge of the Event Horizon Telescope was fundamentally resolution. The black hole at the center of the Milky Way is not the largest black hole in the universe. It's not the closest black hole in the universe, but it is the closest large black hole. Right? And it turns out to have the largest angular cross-section. That ring-like feature will be the largest on the sky of any black hole that we know about. And that's about 1/100 millionth of a degree. Okay, it's about 50 microarc seconds on the sky. Forget about stellar mass black holes. They're a million times smaller. Okay, to achieve a resolution that would allow you to see that, you would need something 100 times bigger than even the next generation telescopes, like the 30-meter telescope. So this is not an optical project. And we opted for building an Earth-sized telescope. If you were to build such a thing, the basic idea would be that the photons would be coming off different regions of your mirror. And at the right time, because you've chosen your mirror to be a parabola, they'll come into focus and you'll make an image. There are political difficulties with making mirrors across the entire Earth. And so the solution that radio astronomers have hit upon for nearly half a century is to break the mirror up into pieces and only reflect photons effectively at shards of your large mirror. And in fact, don't reflect them at all, but record them. And when I say record them, I don't mean take an exposed image. I mean actually record the waves. So you have the phase information and the amplitude information. And then on large computers, complete the process of bringing them into focus. Okay, and that's how interferometers work. That's what the Event Horizon Telescope is. It's not the first global interferometer, but it is the shortest wavelength interferometer. And since the fraction limit goes as wavelength divided by the size of your telescope, that makes it the highest resolution Earth-based telescope. And there were six stations in the 2017 telescopes at six sites around the world for the 2017 observations that lead to the images that we'll talk about today. Okay. Now, it's not quite true that it's simply pieces of the mirror. In that sense, in fact, every pair of telescopes gives us a piece of the mirror. And there's one incredibly important ingredient that I've left out, and that's patience. As you wait through the night, The Earth rotates, our telescopes move in space, and because they move in space, the pairs of telescopes are presenting different orientations relative to the source far away, in this case M87, and fill in the aperture in a very literal sense. Okay, that means that our mirror is this rather hideous-looking collection of blue streaks. Imagine if your mirror was not a uniform silvered plane or parabola, but in fact you only had it silvered on the streaks and it was completely black everywhere else. That's what a radio interferometer is really, really dealing with. And as you might imagine, that leads to a really terrible PSF. So producing images is an exercise in deconvolving the pathological PSF created by these streaks. And there's two solutions to doing this, image reconstruction. The first is a straight up deconvolution. You know what the diffraction pattern is and you try to fit it out. This is the clean algorithm. And the second is some non-parametric fitting method or regularized maximum likelihood, where you have some rasterized distribution of brightness across your image plane, and then you enforce things like positivity. So the intensity should be positive definite. That one's pretty free. But then smoothness and sparseness might come in just based on past historic experience with images. So there are some assumptions, but they're relatively weak. Of course, since none of this is particularly simple or straightforward, it's not quite as simple as doing an inverse Fourier transform. There's always the concern about bias, and indeed, the dirty beam, the beam pattern or the PSF of this particular kind of mirror looks hideous and has all kinds of strange features in it. We did spend a large amount of time worrying about bias. How do we know that we're seeing labradoodles and not fried chicken, chihuahuas and not muffins, rings and not discs? And the answer to that, addressing this, was to perform blind imaging challenges with multiple teams spread across the world using very different methods and seeing, using simulated data, what kinds of images they would reconstruct in different circumstances. And key to this would be ensuring that when you made simulated data using the same properties of the EHT observations of M87, came from underlying truth images that were rings or ring-like, that you produced rings or ring-like images for every team. When you put in things that were clearly not rings, like doubles or disks, once again, we got something that didn't look like rings. And of course, you could play the game of putting in simulations and seeing how well you reproduce those, but I think even more important is that an image of M87 was not the only astronomical source that we reported an image of in April. There is also 3C279. And if you look at the raw visibilities by eye, they don't look qualitatively different, but the reconstructed image is certainly not a ring. And it shouldn't be. We don't resolve the black hole in 3C279. It's much further away. Okay, we see it's double structure.
That's supposed to be a jet, I guess.
I'm not even going to talk about what it's supposed to be. I'm just going to say it's not a ring. Okay?
But you showed it, so.
It's in the paper. Well, there'll be another paper soon about exactly what it is. Okay, so we have confidence that when we see rings, this image, the ring we see in this image, is not a artifact in the analysis, but exists in reality in the data. Okay, so that's great. That's in some sense, this is a data visualization exercise. But science is a quantitative business. So how do we take that sort of thing, or the EHT observations more generally, and make quantitative measurements? So answer questions like, if it's really a ring, how big is it? How fat is it? If it's really coming from lensed emission about a black hole, what would the associated mass of the black hole be? And perhaps even before all of this, are we seeing shadows at all? We'd also like to be able to quantitatively assess how on point or not on point are those simulations that we had before. Each of these,
Can I ask one question about your test case before? So one thing I did notice is that the algorithms like to find contrast. So when you gave it like a patch, a bright patch, it tried to find dark and light spots in it.
No. Like here.
Or all three of them.
I think they do so slightly differently. So
I'm just wondering whether the contrast between bright and dark is important for your analysis.
The question of how dark are the dark bits and how bright are the bright bits are definitely interesting. I don't think we necessarily get at them from images. This team, team three, uses an algorithm that promotes, that unpenalizes. There's a word for this that I'm just missing, it's early. Sparseness. And as a result, it's trying to collect all the flux into as small a region as it can. So it's doing exactly what you're saying. This is a standard clean algorithm, and it's just very fuzzy and diffuse, and it doesn't necessarily attempt to make dark patches. I don't think that there's a sparseness in Team 1's algorithm.
So I guess one thing that's puzzling, maybe it's related to the question Chris is asking, is that it looks like you have a perfectly symmetric input, but then the output is not symmetric. So what breaks the symmetry?
Oh.
I guess it would be the top.
That.
Yeah, okay.
And that's actually quite significant. It makes it very difficult, in fact, to measure symmetry. So our ability to assert with confidence symmetry isn't as good as you might think. We can make things that are symmetric look very asymmetric, and vice versa,
right,
just because the UV coverage is not uniform, not symmetric. Okay, so in the next 15 minutes, I want to talk about how we measure these things and how we infer physical results from them. And I'm going to describe three ways we do that. The first is geometric estimators in the visibility domain. So don't make an image at all. Just analyze the interferometric observables. These would be the visibilities related to Fourier transform of the image. These are the things that are actually the output of the correlation process or the interferometric experiment. These are the things that get turned into images down the line. A second one is a comparison with GRMHD simulations. So this is an attempt to quantify how applicable or not applicable those simulations are. And that carries its own difficulties. And the third is, let's take that image as some version of what's really there and try to assess features on the image. So each of these three methods are ways to get quantitative answers, and we'll go through them in turn, beginning with the geometric modeling. So in this case, what you do is you assume some sort of geometric shape on the sky. Okay, so this is reminiscent of the very first VLBI experiments where you would assume something was a block or a square or maybe two squares, right? The first jet observation came from assuming a model that was two squares. Same thing here, we assume a geometric shape on the sky that has an overall size. It can have a hole in the middle. That hole can be deeper or shallower. It can be offset to give this an asymmetry in the structure. The flux can be distributed across this in an asymmetric way. It can be smooth. Okay, it gives you an idea of how sharp the transitions are. And of course, it can be oriented in any direction. And there's more than one way to do this. We explored a number of ways and settled on two as a means to go after things like how big and how fat and how deep is the depression. I'm not going to bore you with the details. I'm just going to plot one of these triangle plots for those two separate models analyzed in two very different ways, looking at the data in different ways. And if you choose a reasonable set of these parameters, flux, diameter, average diameter, the width, sharpness, shadow, and orientation, they are all roughly uncorrelated. This analysis can be done not just once, but you can do this on both of two bands, high and low band, on each of 4 days. You can do this 8 different ways. And when you do that, 8 different ways, combining data in different ways and with different methods. For things like the average diameter, we achieve remarkable consistency. So again, this is the consistency that breeds confidence that we're looking at features in the data and not assumptions in
but
analysis.
The bits were very inconsistent.
The what?
The bits, the previous plot.
Yeah, so the widths have subtly different definitions between the two models. And I wouldn't trust any of the width measurements beyond upper limits. Yeah.
So you're assuming this is a circular pattern. Why not logical?
We'll get there. That's a good question. We've done some of that, but that's for another time. I think at the level that we believe what a measurement is, having gone through this process on a number of simulated data sets, we believe these things are all very consistent. Interpreting that diameter, though, is not trivial. There's been some to-do recently about what's a photon ring and what's a lensed image of an accretion flow and all of that. My response would be, that's a brilliant point. You should read our papers, because we do spend a lot of time talking about exactly that point. The size of the photon ring is fixed by gravity, but the size of the average diameter is determined by gravity plus the physics and distribution of emission in the emission region. That is to say, this diffuse emission will generally pull the diameter outward. And so we have to worry about that. Okay, and that's dependent upon what exactly you thought was going on in the emission region. And we have many different models for what is happening in the emission region, and associatedly, we have many different relationships between the average diameter and the diameter of the shadow or the photon ring. So we engaged in a calibration exercise where we took a set of GRMHD simulation images, created simulated data for each one of them, fit them through this entire analysis with both methods, and measured this average diameter, and then based upon that measurement, inferred a systematic error budget and a multiplicative calibration factor that relates this average diameter to the mass in angular units, gm over c squared divided by the distance to the source. Okay, this number is not 9.6 or 10.4. It's bigger than that. It's around 11.5, and that's just the statement that there's more emission from outside than inside, and so you bias yourself outwards. So we do worry about this. If our calibration set is wrong, then our calibration factor is wrong by an equal margin. We can take that calibration factor and turn that into an average gravitational radius, again measured in microarc seconds. This is really a measurement of mass divided by distance up to fundamental constants. And we have remarkable consistency amongst the individual measurements, but there are these very large 10%-ish theoretical systematic error bars associated with not knowing exactly what the underlying emission pattern is. Okay, so if we knew tomorrow what kind of model best, or could restrict dramatically the models that are relevant for M87, we could drop these error bars very rapidly. Okay, so that is the geometric modeling, GRMHD simulation comparisons. So we produced the largest library of GRMHD simulations ever assembled. This was done over many different institutions and multiple continents and multiple HPC consortia. Here is the potentially seizure-inducing simulation wall. This is just a subset of the simulation movies that we have. So how do we assess whether or not these look like the data? Well, the first thing you can do is you can take a snapshot from any one of these movies, and you can try to compare it directly to the interferometric observables, directly to the output of the experiment. Of course, we don't know what the mass of the object is, so we can stretch this in space. We don't know how bright it was, if we got the accretion rate exactly right in the simulation or not, so you can change its overall brightness. And we don't necessarily know the orientation of this, so you can rotate the whole thing around, so that creates a model that a handful of parameters for each one of these snapshots that you can go off and fit.
So do you also average over time? Because I guess that...
This is a snapshot. This is a single frame in the movie.
But then the image, the observed image is averaged over time.
Over about eight hours.
Right.
But the time scale for things to change in M87 is more like 2 weeks.
Okay, so I guess snapshot is really not that different from 8 hours.
Well, that's a good question, right? So we're probably seeing a snapshot of whatever's going on in M87. Is that like the snapshots in a simulation? Is a different question. So if we look at simulated image, and here's blurred to about the resolution of the EHD, we have maybe 20 independent pixels across the image, right? So 20 independent beams across the image. And we have SNRs between 10 and 100 in each one of those pixels. Okay, if you had 20 modes and you had to fit everything to SNRs of 10 to 100, you have something, and you permit 50% variations in the brightness due to the turbulent structures in the underlying emission region, you need between 1 million and 10 to the 25 realizations before you get lucky and something fits within your random errors. 1 million is already too long. 10 to the 25 is absurd. In fact, you can't even run the simulations this long. So, forget about your computational limits. If you tried to run them this long, you'd get nonsense. So how do you deal with that? And the answer is to return to the idea of what does a fit mean. Fit is a model that is as good as you expect given the random fluctuations that you understand. And those random fluctuations come first in observational errors, that's what we were just talking about, but secondly, in the stochastic theoretical errors. These are the random fluctuations in the emission regions. These are the turbulence in the emission model. Okay? And so this is the one we always think about, but this is the one that we had to think about in order to make this comparison with the simulations. And so the question we ask is subtly different. It's, is the average simulation image, so taken not quite as typical, but average simulation image, as like the data as a typical simulation snapshot frame is like as like the average simulation image? That is to say, we take from the simulations an average and use that as a proxy for the model that we would get from that simulation. But we also take from the simulations a model of the noise in the simulation, okay, and take that as a proxy for how much fluctuation we could have, right? So low noise, high noise, very different. So there are two ways for these models to fail. One is the average doesn't look anything like reality. The second is the average looks too much like reality, that a typical snapshot should be much further away. In other words, the noise model is wrong. I think much to the chagrin of some of the simulators, it turned out that given this test, 51 out of 60 of the models we tried passed. I think that's remarkably good news because it means that the overall model paradigm seems to work quite well. That doesn't mean that they all have exactly the same image. Here's just three random snapshots selected from the set of things that fit. Two of these have a photon ring that looks fairly similar in size, but one of them is very different, and it's exactly this business about the flux outside the ring biasing you towards smaller masses or larger average diameters. Yes?
Can you say just a few words generically of what distinguishes the models that work versus those that don't? Is there some qualitative, semi-quantitative conclusion you could draw?
No. I mean, so we can rule out, subject to whatever biases are imposed by the details of the electron distribution functions, nearly maximally spinning MAD models in which the spin is counter to the accretion flow direction or something. So you could, but this is like baseball. This is like this pitcher's never lost a game played in the second half of Sunday. On Thursdays and Tuesdays, whatever, right? So I'm not sure that that's a meaningful statement yet. It'll get better. But I would be reticent to rule out generic models, yeah. generic class of models. So we can't say MAD models or SANE models or something.
So Avery, for these different models, do they give different values for like the black hole parameters?
Yeah. So this is the image at the best fit parameter for that image. So this guy is noticeably smaller. So the mass is smaller. Okay. You can take the reconstructed masses across all the snapshots from a given simulation and create a posterior for the mass measurement, assuming that model was the right model. That's shown here for four different models. They're all very different spins and different kinds of models. They're all more or less consistent. And when you combine all of that again, you get a mass measurement in this funny units, angular size, m over d. And this is quite similar to what we found with the geometric model fitting. The third way to try to get numbers off these images is to put rulers directly on the images themselves. So I'd like to pretend what we did was vastly more sophisticated than this. You know, it's only slightly more sophisticated. You fit some sort of ridge finder, use some sort of ridge finding algorithm to go identify where the bright ridge is. And then based on that, determine what the average diameter is. You can even determine asymmetry, modulo, what went into making the image, et cetera. That's effectively putting a ruler across. We also have matched filtering methods, which work quite well for this process as well, and reach very similar results. This has its own independent set of biases. Something that we've taken to calling the Moran bias occurs when you have a ring-like structure and you convolve that with a Gaussian. Just geometric focusing. So it has nothing to do with telescopes or light or optics, just geometric focusing. The fact that things get closer together as they go inside the circle and farther apart as you go outside the circle causes the ridge line to move inward. Okay? And so that means that as soon as you start to fuzz up this image because of assumptions in the image reconstruction, you also bias how big it is, in addition to the bias induced by the fact that the emission region is outside the photon ring. Okay? That means that we engaged in a separate calibration exercise for these, where we took the simulated data sets, the same set of models that we used for the geometric calibration, the geometric estimator calibration, and we constructed images. Okay, so now the imaging is part of the analysis. We constructed images, applied the ridge finding algorithm, and determined what that relationship between average diameter and m over d was. And this number's different, right? Before it was around 11.5, now it's around 10.8, 10.9. The end result, though, in the total mass in gravitational units, m over d, I'm sorry, in angular units, for the different image reconstruction methods, okay, and on the different days, is again very similar. And that brings me to synthesis and the implications. So this is probably my favorite plot after the image from the entire six papers. It is the most boring plot that I can imagine. We have our three different methods, each of which were executed by multiple teams independently on multiple different days. So we could have made an extraordinarily busy plot that had, you know, of order 20 points for each one of these. And they're all spot on. They're all exactly the same. And so we really do think we've measured something about the size of the black hole. We're all dominated by systematic errors in calibration. And I think these size measurements are the first major science results of the EHT. And they're not incidental. They don't, they're not simply another way to measure the size of an astronomical object. The reason is in part that there was a controversy about the mass. There were two methods for measuring the mass before. One was to look at the dynamics of gas on tens of parsec scales and the dynamics of stars on tens of parsec scales. Okay, and they were different by a factor of two. Now that we've measured the dynamics of light on photon orbit scales, near horizon scales, we pick one of these. And so now there's implications for how gas feeds the black hole. There's also a test of general relativity inherent in this. The thing that relates the dynamics of stars on tens of parsec scales and the dynamics of light on horizon scales is in fact your theory of gravity. And it didn't have to match, but it does. And so we have a 10% test of general relativity across four orders of magnitude around a supermassive black hole.
It seems that you're picking and choosing data. You could have looked at the random set of general relativity is broken.
You're not supposed to notice. I can only report my prior was the I never believed the red point.
Okay.
You can apply your prior on that statement.
Do you understand why the red is off?
Yeah. So the red point is obtained by looking at the velocity, the spatial distribution of velocity along the line of sight from a gas disk, and then assuming that gas disk is a Keplerian disk. When you look at, for example, the center of our galaxy, it's very clear that that's not true. And in fact, were you to apply the kind of analysis they applied to M87's gas disk.
It's not
Keplerian. It's plunging, so it's not in circular. I'm sorry, circular Keplerian orbits. I should have said circular. In the center of our galaxy, it's very clearly not circular orbits. We have plunging orbits. It's not a uniform disk. You have the spiral arms and all that in the mini spiral. And so, if you were to apply this analysis to the center of our galaxy, which was effectively done in the late 70s and early 80s, because the resolution of telescopes weren't as good, you got a number that was similarly wrong. So I suspect strongly that this is a consequence of a mixture of errors in the inclination, assumed inclination of the disk, and or incomplete elements in the modeling. And we recently wrote a paper, which just got published, which tries to fix up those, shows that even modest corrections to both of those things produce mass estimates are consistent. This comes from the dynamics of stars, which are collisionless fluid, and it's harder to make similar kinds of systematic errors. Of course, they come with its own variety. So that's why I find one more credible than the other. I have 1 minute left. We'll go quickly. Okay, so the second thing is there a shadow in the center. Well, we have the right size given the prior from this guy, and I just said that I believe this one more than that one. It's narrow. There's a sharp transition. This is something that you can't see in the images, but you can see in the geometric analyses that it very rapidly drops from being bright to being dim. Circular to maybe 3-to-2 axis ratios. It's not worse than that, and stationary. And so it does look like a shadow. That doesn't mean that GR is right, but it does mean that GR is not wrong in a way that would create more than 10% deviations in any of those. It's asymmetric. It's bright in the south. Okay, that's present in all of these models. The jet in each of these models is going off to your right. Okay, and that was expected. Remember, here was that 3-millimeter image that shows the jet extending off towards the west, off to your right, okay? And if we were to zoom in, it's bright on the south in the wrong direction. And remember, I said that was exactly what simulations predict, that helical flow is going to brighten on one side, not in the direction of the jet. So I see this as a confirmation, or at least a consistency check with the Blandford-Nayak process, these rotation-powered jet models. If you adopt that assumption, then you can start to make arguments for the existence of horizons modulo a number of astrophysical assumptions by looking at the surface emission. Were there a photosphere that we could see? This is all predicated on understanding how mass or matter is accreting onto the object. And so the confirmation of that general picture for how jets operate was important. And I just want to emphasize here that it's not the dimness of the interior of the shadow that gives the constraint. That's actually quite hard to make a case for. It's the actually the dimness up at optical wavelengths, from optical observations, in comparison to the bump, the thermal bump you would get from surface emission. from this visible photosphere. And now there are caveats, and I'd be happy to talk about them, but you know, this is the kind of thing that we were trying to constrain. And so I think there's tentative evidence. Certainly GR predicts no such thing. There's also the nice fact that combined with another great window on black holes that we now have, LIGO, studying stellar mass black holes, over 8 orders of magnitude in this plot and 9 orders of magnitude in reality, we have what looks like confirmations of general relativity on stellar mass black holes and for supermassive black holes, which is providing evidence for this idea that mass is just a scaling in between. We have a whole lot of different things as a consequence of mass, but these two things are homologous. What's next? In short order, we'll be publishing the first polarized images. None of these are all just simulations. It says something about electron distribution functions and magnetic field structures. We'll be looking at other targets. There's a picture of the center of our galaxy. This is a radio image of the center of our galaxy. That's not a marker. That's the radio image of Sag A star. This bar and this bar are the same scale in Schwarzschild radii. Okay, there's M87. These are very different objects. The comparing and contrasting will be very interesting. And they'll move. So more than 10 years ago, we tried to come up with a model for flares in the galactic center and suggested that these were orbiting bright emission regions. This received a boost last year with the first detection of a wobble by a near-infrared interferometer, gravity, that saw the light during a flare wander back and forth or wander around in a circle in the same way that you would anticipate if you had a off-center orbiting bright feature. And that suggests that we'll be able to see these things in the Event Horizon Telescope. And if we do, we'll rapidly evolve from stationary images to moving pictures. And we have numerous ways now for trying to generate moving pictures. We have dynamical modeling, but we also have ways of reconstructing dynamical images. I would be remiss if I didn't remind everybody that the Event Horizon Telescope is truly an Earth-sized collaboration in more ways than one. Not only do you need people spread around the globe to operate a telescope around the globe, but you also need people spread around a wide variety of expertise and experience. And here's a picture that's not everybody, but it's the most inclusive picture that we have at the moment. And all of the honor and glory belongs to the collaboration. The errors are certainly all mine. And so I'll just leave up a summary slide and open it to any additional questions. Thank you.
So, questions or comments?
What is it now that we're seeing? Well, first of all, I didn't see, you only mentioned incarnation a few times, but the whole image is practically circular, as if there is no incarnation. The other question is, what if it has a ring around a black hole, the ring should also come in front of the black hole. So it's not obvious that it has to be a completely dark black spot there.
Right. So the first question is, what inclination and how might you know? So we do have these dynamical measurements of the jet from longer wavelength observations and at larger scales. And we do have detections at 7 millimeters of the forward jet, so this is the one that's coming towards us, and the counter jet, the one going away from us. So both of these are providing information about the relative inclination of the jets. Okay, and we know that that means the jets are between 10 and 20 degrees from the line of sight. The presumption is that the spin is aligned with the jet, and that means the spin is between 10 and 20. The degree of asymmetry in the ring or in the shadow region in the photon ring for black holes, even highly spinning black holes that are viewed 10 to 20 degrees from their symmetry axis, is very small. So all the images are going to be approximately circular. We did explore variations around this 10 to 20. I think our default value of the inclination was 17. We went up and down by 5 degrees and redid everything. And there's no strong dependence found on that. Okay, so John would be somewhat different, but this face on is.
I'm saying on the accretion disk, accretion ring.
Okay.
That's not the ring that you're talking about.
Yeah, so that this light ring is produced by the photons that are bent around, right? So it's purely a gravitational effect. Now, the accretion disk and accretion ring. So I did gloss over what is doing the emitting. There is an accretion flow onto the black hole at the center. That's not the brightest part. The brightest part in all of the simulations is a region where this flow is interacting with the highly magnetized jet. So it's not inside the jet. It's not inside the accretion flow all the time. Sometimes it gets crushed down to the accretion flow, but it's really this boundary layer between the jet and the accretion flow, because that's where you have strong magnetic fields, which you need for synchrotron emission, and you have hot, dense plasmas, which you need for lots of synchrotron emission. So we have this conical kind of shell-like emission region in all of these models. And again, that's aligned 10 degrees, 20 degrees off the line of sight. So we're almost looking at it face down on the top of that emission region. Nevertheless, there is emission in the middle of the accretion region as that material flows inside the region that is defined by the photon ring. Okay, so that's like foreground emission. It's certainly coming from much further up. But it does fill in at least in projection inside somewhat. So we do see that effect. But it's less so here just because of the geometry of the system, which is already pre-constrained.
The danger is, you also mentioned positivity as a constraint on the signal, because you can't emit a negative signal. But positivity means that as soon as you hit that boundary, you start making things completely black. So the blackness of the center could be, in principle, an artifact of the software.
Well, so the positivity is just saying that the intensity can't be negative,
yeah.
Right? But
so maybe zero is sometimes the closest you get to the signal. Bug in the system, so to speak. You might get artificially a black spot. That's what I'm
as opposed to a negative intensity spot.
Well,
it can be any positive value it wants there, right? So if we just go grab our favorite picture. Okay, right, so it can have any value it wants in here as long as it's not negative, right? But a negative intensity, what would that mean?
A mistake or an error in the estimates in the boundary of the plot. So suppose that the problem is not as good as you thought it.
Yeah.
So it generates dark spots. I could imagine it's probably generating dark spots as being the best approximation of something.
Right.
The algorithm would have said to be negative, and you say, no, it can't be negative, so I make it black. But that's, of course, not right.
Now this is a question about fit quality assessment. Every image that we showed has a reduced chi-squared of order unity. We have detailed model fits where we have very good control over the number of model parameters involved, and there we get reduced chi-squares of unity. So this is, regardless of whether or not it's true, it's at least formally consistent in all the ways we understand with the data. And it's not the best, okay? It's formally consistent. And you can generate a whole population of these. So in fact, in our imaging program, we generated thousands upon thousands of these images with subtle variations. And the things that we report are really the things that are generic amongst all of those. And this is an attempt at asking, well, amongst all the images that are formally consistent with the data, what's generic about them? For example, you see that this is a blob here and a blob there. That changes. So that's not a thing. Okay, that is brighter on the bottom, doesn't change. That's generic. Right, so that's a thing. That's dark in the middle. Doesn't change.
Just to be the devil's advocate. Suppose that you ignore the condition that the signal is positive. Of course, we know the signal is positive. But suppose you ignore it, and you then ask, what's the best fit? Do you then get spots where the best fit would give a negative signal, just meaning that of the ball it cannot be completely right, but You see what I'm trying to say? And now your algorithm says, well, the best net fit will be not that the signal is negative, but the signal is zero.
Yeah.
So you see a black spot.
So I think
and
one.
That's what I'm worried about.
One of the problems, well, but that would be a pathology in the fit. But then we shouldn't be seeing better fits than reduced chi-squareds of one, right? Okay.
It's running.
Okay.
So we can keep discussing during the day.
Sure.
So let's thank Gary again.